I am a riverkeeper for 20 years. I am the longest-serving riverkeeper in the Chesapeake Bay, a senior citizen. It wasn't true when I started. And before I started, as was said, I worked in television and radio. That's the only career I had envisioned. When I was 15 years old, I would leave junior high school early in Amherst, Massachusetts, and ride my bicycle to WFCR, where I would anchor the news that evening, because the engineers there had taken pity on me as a young man and taught me stuff, mentored me, showed me stuff. This story is about something that happened to me that really informs my work and my ethic in terms of doing water keeping. After about 20 years in that other career, which was a successful career, I met a lot of famous people. I used to work in the White House Office of Communications in the 80s, where I would save jokes and give them to Ronald Reagan, who would write the punchlines down because he was very zealous about asking permission to use the joke and getting the punchlines right. Traveled with The Who for MTV, went on tour with those guys, did all kinds of interesting things, but then I hit a wall where I wanted to invest myself in real people problems. You know, working in television and radio is a fantasy world. And I felt like we weren't changing anything. And so I went to law school, which I dearly loved, had a great time researching and learning stuff that I had no clue about. While on break in my first year of law school, I took a freelance job from my old career as a paymaster. Paymaster is a person who basically writes checks to people. I got hired to go to Birmingham, Alabama to work on a live telecast at the convention center, and my job was to sit in a little cubicle with a checkbook and basically write checks to local vendors, carpenters, stylists, electricians, grips, and other people whom you pick up on the road when you're with a traveling TV show. In between writing checks, I was doing law school homework, so I had a big stack of books during that part of my life. Then the stack of books followed me wherever I went. So there I am, reading a book in between writing checks, and the executive producer walks by, really mad. What are you doing reading books? What am I paying all this money for? Make yourself useful. Hey, look, there's that still photographer over there, that old relic. He was really kind of mean, this old guy. Looked like he was close to 80 years old. Was the still photographer for the production. He had a limp. Wasn't particularly well-dressed, had a battered photo bag and a beat-up old tripod. He said, why don't you go and, I don't know, carry that old guy's tripod. You know, we paid all this money and they sent this relic over here. I mean, it was really very disrespectful about this guy. I went over, introduced myself. He said, hi, just call me Chris. There we are walking around the convention center in Birmingham, and everybody there knows this guy. He's waving to people, almost like he's a rock star. At some point, he says, you know, I'm kind of hungry. How about you? You want some lunch? I said, sure. So we walk into somebody else's event. There's actually a wedding reception going on, and people actually get out of line and let us cut into the line. This guy has a lot of gravitas. So after lunch, we're sitting in the hallway, just chewing the fat. You know, we swap stories about our lives, things we were working on. He says, you know, you seem like a nice guy. My daughter would be right about your age, I think, if she hadn't been blown up in that church. Church? Bomb? Birmingham? In 1963, Birmingham was known as Bombingham in the Civil Rights Movement. There were so many terrorist bombings. The 16th Street Baptist Church was blown up by 16 sticks of dynamite. Four little girls were blown to bits in that. It was a flashpoint for the Civil Rights Movement. It changed everything in terms of the tactics of the movement and the focus. It was worldwide news. And this guy, Chris McNair, was the father of one of those little girls. He was plunged into a national spotlight. He had been a local still photographer. He became a photographer for Jet magazine, and he became a contemporary of Martin Luther King and many other icons of the civil rights movement. He later was elected to the legislature in Alabama, the first African-American elected to that legislature in the post-construction, post-Reconstruction era. So I'm stunned, I mean, completely speechless that this guy that nobody was paying attention to had an incredible story to tell. And he says to me, you know, I built like a memorial to my daughter, whose name, incidentally, was Denise. Would you like to see it? Well, absolutely. So we go out in the parking lot. This guy's got a battered old car. We throw his camera gear in the back. He drives me across town, pretty kind of run-down part of town. He's got a thriving business. It's a photo mat. I mean, this is in the era before digital photography. This was 2001, somewhere around there, I think. And he takes me to the back of the business, which is bustling, and there's a room and a bench outside. And he says, go on in and look around. I can't go in there. It's too painful, right? This is a wound that will never heal, right? He sits outside smoking a cigarette while I poke around in this museum where he has put under a glass case the clothing that Denise was wearing the day she was in that bombing and various mementos of all sorts, actually. There was a letter framed on the wall written to the family by Spike Lee, the filmmaker, about, I guess he was asking for permission to use some of the information from the bombing and have access to various files and records. Spike Lee, incidentally, has handwriting that kind of looks like he writes with a crayon. A handwritten letter is what he had. So I took my time and I walked around, and when I walked out, he said, thank you. He said, thank you for looking at this stuff. He called me a cab, saw me off on the curb out in front of the business. He said, I've had a really nice time meeting you, young man. I hope you have a nice life. And I never saw that guy again. 2 or 3 years ago, I saw in the newspaper that he had passed away at the age of 94. And the moral of this story is that it informs my waterkeeper work, because it blew my mind that this guy, whom the executive producer had kind of written the story in his head that wasn't true, that this guy wasn't just some bum who had wandered in on his payroll. He was a guy, actually, who wasn't the full-time photographer. The actual photographer had called in sick that day. He's the boss. He was filling in for a guy who didn't show for work. So he doesn't go out in the field that much anymore. But more importantly, as a community advocate, as a guy who works with communities to solve problems, I learned from this and other experiences how vital it is to be open to hearing what people's stories are. Not to assume that the person sitting next to you doesn't have a story to share, because just about everybody does. But that also you'll find those stories in the places least expected. And this guy who dropped his shields and showed me something brutally painful, a loss that would never heal, a wound that would never heal, trusted me enough to show me something about himself that was deeply personal. And that was an honor, and it was flattering, but it was also a connection, of which there are so many of those connections waiting to be had, that the person sitting next to you has a story to tell that you would never imagine, wouldn't dream of, unless you build that trust, unless you have that bond or build that connection. And in a way, that's what this work is about as a waterkeeper. It's making connections with communities where water, something deeply personal to everyone, right, is the basis for that connection. And your willingness to hear those stories and to explore those stories, I think, has everything to do with who we are as human beings, as people on this shared journey. So I was very, very touched by what this guy showed me. Like I said, that's an incredibly personal thing that this guy experienced, that wound that would never heal. And to share it with a total stranger, I thought was an extraordinary thing. So I suspect that's a downbeat kind of story, but it has an edge to it, I think, that is hopeful. And so I encourage you to share your stories. Thank you.